Hello, this is Mark Peacock, and welcome to the Travel Commons Podcast. This is Travel Commons Podcast number 154, recorded Tuesday, August 13th, 2019. This is the podcast giving the voice of the traveler. It's more about the journey than the destination. The only topic on this edition of the Travel Commons Podcast, will you still love Uber and Lyft when their prices go up? So coming to you today from the Residence Inn, just off the Main Street Pedestrian Mall in downtown Charlottesville, Virginia. Leaving behind last episode's multi-mic, big mixer board, sound-baffled podcast studio, specialty-built podcast studio, to go old school. Back to the Travel Commons roots with the mobile rig in a hotel room. You know, I was actually thinking about going way, way back, so if it's further back than old school, I guess it's sort of going kindergarten, and recording this in the bathroom. But there's a kind of a noisy exhaust fan that I can't figure out how to turn off. Actually, there may end up being a bit of traffic noise in the background here, and maybe even some thunder if the black clouds out my window live up to their potential. But this episode actually might be one of the shorter ones of recent memory. I'm trying to get this in before Irene and I head out to Krakow and Budapest Thursday night, a couple nights. Now, this is my fourth week back in Charlottesville. Not much has changed since my last commute here back at the end of the year. American Eagle and United Express have a couple of direct regional jets, a day nonstop from Chicago. And when weather knocks those flights out, Richmond is an hour and a bit drive to the east, or Washington Dulles is 2 hours north as a last resort. Charlottesville is still a five-gate airport. There's a bar in the middle that still has a surprisingly good local craft beer selection. The bartender actually still recognizes me, though she still asks for my ID every time I sit at the bar. So not much has changed at Charlottesville Airport. However, I have to say my approach to flying here has changed a bit. I've talked about this in prior episodes. I've always planned my travel to maximize my time at home with my family. So given the choice between flying out the night before or taking a 7 a.m. flight out the day of, I'd take the latter. I'd fly out the day of. The trade-off, though, is, you know, those sorts of travel plans don't deal real well with travel delays. A two-hour flight delay the night before is annoying, but you're probably not going to miss anything. That same delay the morning of a meeting may mean, well, I just don't even take that flight. I've missed that meeting. And I've had all that and more happen with flights to Charlottesville. So this time, with the kids graduated and moving out of the house, and now that we've downsized from the house to the city apartment, my wife thinking that I'm underfoot a bit too much, the need to maximize my time at home has, I don't know, it's eased a bit. Let's put it that way. So I've been booking on these trips to Charlottesville now this past month. I've been booking a more, let's call them more resilient itineraries, flying out the night before, staying over an extra day so I can fly out after lunch before the summer humidity kind of spools up the afternoon thunderstorms, which has actually done pretty well. And even with this last week when actually thunderstorms in Chicago had my evening flight to Charlottesville posting a three-hour delay by noon. But given the time, I had more than enough time to kind of swing my endpoint from Charlottesville over to Richmond. And actually, I did it all pretty seamlessly through United's app, which I found pretty impressive. My travel plans, I don't know, they may not be as optimized as before, or maybe they are, but for different things, like cutting down on personal stress and also cutting out my need to bitch tweet. So following up, we've had a thread over, I don't know, a couple of episodes about Freebird, a flight rebooking service. So back in episode 151, Travel Commons listener Mika Prakala sent in a note about his great experience with Freebird, how they picked up a Southwest flight cancellation and rebooked him onto a Delta flight, all while he was still in the air on that first Southwest leg. Saved him a huge disruption, well worth it, he said, for the $19 a leg fee. I mentioned in the last episode that Amex Travel has been offering free Freebird coverage, say that one three times fast, for flights that I book on the Amex Travel site with my Amex Platinum card. So Freebird has actually been covering these past few trips to Charlottesville. I get a text the night before and the morning of my flight assuring me that Freebird is monitoring them. And then when I land, they say, hey, you've landed on time. Have a nice day. And so last week when that outbound O'Hare to Charlottesville 6 p.m. flight started posting delays at noon, I got texts from Freebird letting me know that they were monitoring the delay, but it hadn't yet tripped their four-hour trigger. But knowing that there weren't going to be many alternative flights to either Richmond or Dulles later in the evening, and knowing that I was sort of on more or less the last flight, last direct flight to Charlottesville, both I was on a United, like I said, I was on a United 6 p.m. and American has one right at about the same time. So I didn't feel comfortable waiting for United to push over that 4 hour delay. And then, you know, and then my guess was is then they'd cancel it. And so, like I said before, I ended up moving myself over to United 6 p.m. Richmond flight, which was on time because it was a big 737 jet, mainline jet, not an RJ. And so I ended up getting into my hotel around 10 p.m. after an hour Uber ride. And then, kind of indulging in that little bit of travel schadenfreude that I will do, I kept actually tracking that O'Hare to Charlottesville flight on FlightAware. It finally took off at 11 p.m. Central Time, 5 hours late, arriving Charlottesville at 2 a.m. Eastern. So it did eventually cross Freebird's four-hour threshold, but it was after they had already picked up that I had moved over to Richmond, to the Richmond flight. And I'm also not sure if there was time, you know, when they tripped that threshold, if there was actually time to catch an alternative flight that night. So I'm glad I switched myself to that Richmond flight, but I don't know, maybe, you know, kind of thinly traveled direct routes are not the best use case for Freebird. Maybe it's actually sort of tight connections like Mika did. I don't know. Now, also back in episode 151, I talked about how I tried out the alpha version of Google Maps augmented reality, their AR directions. And that's where, if you remember, I talked about it. I used it in Stockholm, where you hold up the phone, kind of, you know, hold the phone straight up, and the display uses the camera to show the streetscape that's sort of right in front of you. And then they overlay the directions, sort of street names and arrows. Those directions are overlaid on the real-time image. I thought it was kind of cool. Irene and the kids were, I have to say, less impressed. But now you can judge for yourself, because Google announced last week that they've put that AR feature now in public beta. Give it a try and let me know what you think. Now, fast-forwarding one whole episode from episode 151 in May to episode 152 in June, which was really a big jump because right after recording episode 151, we moved from the big house in the suburbs to a 60% smaller high-rise apartment on the lakefront. But in episode 152, I talked about having to recalibrate how I get to the airport. Back in the suburbs, back in Hinsdale, I had my guy, and he'd pick me up for a 30-minute ride, either to O'Hare or to Midway, and it was pretty predictable, but no more. Over the past few weeks, though, I've started to get a feel for it, like 45, 50 minutes to O'Hare, but figure an hour for weird traffic. And in the morning, figure about a 10-minute wait for an Uber or Lyft, and with, you know, in the tab with a tip is around, I don't know, $40, $45. So for this trip, yesterday morning at 5 a.m., I fire up Lyft and Uber while drinking my morning cup of tea to see what's going on. It's $110 on Uber to O'Hare, and it's $60 on Lyft. I mean, what the hell is going on? I mean, I don't know. Maybe all the drivers are sleeping in. They got a late start. So I say, well, you know, I'll get showered. I'll get dressed. I'll gather sort of all my worldly belongings, and I'll check again. Which I did now at about, 5:40. It's now $120 on Uber, Lyft down to 57. So I hit the Lyft button and wait. And then somebody accepts the ride and then immediately cancels. Guess he didn't want to go to O'Hare. So now I fire up Transit, which is my favorite mass transit app. It's developed by some company in Montreal, and they've got mass transit routings for a huge number of cities in the U.S. and Canada, and a few in Europe and Australia, New Zealand. But very much a very good app, highly recommended. Because actually also in Chicago, not only does it handle the CTA, but it also covers Divvy bike share, and then it'll also construct kind of ride share to mass transit routings, typically Lyft, say like, a Lyft ride to the L stop, to the subway stop. So I fired up Transit thinking that, okay, maybe if I couldn't get Lyft O'Hare, then maybe I could get it to the nearest L stop, the blue line that would then take me, straight to O'Hare. But even Transit couldn't find a Lyft. But it did show that across the street from our flat, a bus would pick me up and 18 stops later, drop me off at that L stop. Well, I got nothing else. Actually, I did, but it would involve waking Irene up for what I said was now 5:40 a.m. to have her give me a drive to O'Hare. Truly a last resort. So I decide to give the bus a go. I wheel my luggage across the street. 4 minutes later, the bus shows up. There's me and another guy. No problem putting my luggage on the seat next to me. And actually, we make pretty good time. Not a lot of people waiting at bus stops at 6 a.m. And the traffic is pretty clear, too. All told, we stop maybe 6 times and have, about 8 people on the bus at its most crowded. Now, at the L stop, I had to wait another 5 minutes for the blue line train to show up. And at 6:40, it was a bit more crowded. Almost everyone on the on at least my car on the subway had an O'Hare badge around their necks, pilots, flight attendants, ground staff, except for a couple of passenger-looking folks like me. All told, it took me about an hour, so maybe about 10 minutes longer than what Uber and Lyft were quoting if somebody had come to pick me up. But at $2.50 versus $60 or $120, I don't know. It seems like I made out on that deal. Now, also in episode 152, I talked about earning and burning frequent traveler points rather than saving them because airlines and hotels keep playing with redemption levels and rules that kind of reduce their value, reduce the value of the points. They just decay. Now, Jim McDonough hit me on Twitter with a contra view. Jim said, regarding frequent flyer miles and how they don't appreciate over time, I still like to keep some around in case we need to travel for family emergency situations. The walk-up fare does not compete with the $25 charge to book a frequent flyer ticket at the last minute. Jim, that's actually a very good point. I hadn't thought about that as kind of an emergency stash and a little bit of a better pricing for those last minute flights. But I wonder if that strategy still works as more airlines moved from fixed award schedules, 25,000 points for a super saver or 50,000 points for everyday. Does it still work when they move from the fixed award schedules to dynamic point pricing, the way that Southwest, Delta, and soon United will, where the point price for a flight climbs as the remaining ticket prices do? So it basically, as the ticket prices go up, the number of points go up. I mean, does it, at that point, will it still make sense to pay with points for those last minute flights? I don't know. Now, as I said earlier, Irene and I are heading out Thursday night for a weekend in Krakow, Poland, and then heading down to Budapest for a mix of touring and visits with Irene's family. So actually, I thought this was as good a time as any to try out my iPhone's dual SIM capability. Now, up to now, my usual procedure was to, you know, pull out my my US AT&T SIM and put it into an old HTC One phone that I had, and then pull out my UK EE SIM and put it into my iPhone XS. Usually I was doing this sometime in flight, you know, kind of a bit of a panic drill between the flight attendants clearing out the breakfast trays and then them coming around and making you pack up everything before the final descent. So there I am, like juggling really small pieces of plastic while typically we're bouncing up and down going on final descent. You know, great planning on my part. But anyhow, I would do this. I would swap in the UK EE SIM if I'm going to an EU country. I get to do that until October, at the end of October, I guess. Or then I pick up a local SIM when we land. I do this because local data, as we've talked about before, is just hugely cheaper than an AT&T international plan. The EE plan, their pay-as-you-go plan that I use, it's £10 or $12 with this week's Brexit exchange rate discount. And I get 3 gig of data, 100 minutes of voice, and unlimited text, all for, you know, all within 30 days. More than enough for a week or two of vacation. But I do still want my U.S. number to be able to ring through in case someone back home, you know, needs to reach me and doesn't realize I'm out of the country. Now, I don't carry both phones with me. I carry the iPhone with me during the day, you know, using the local SIM and the cheap local data to run Google Maps and the like. The HTC stays in the hotel room and I check it, you know, for messages or voicemail messages or text, you know, when I get back at night. But with dual SIM capabilities, I should be able to do all of this with just my iPhone. However, the iPhone only has one physical SIM slot. The second is an internal eSIM, kind of like the ones that Apple uses in their cellular Apple Watch. So to make this work, I had to get AT&T to transfer my US number from its physical SIM to the eSIM that's in the phone. My first stop was the local AT&T store. I explained to the store guy what I wanted to do. He looked at me for a moment and said, I'm new. I don't know how to do that, but I can give you an eSIM card if you want. I said, okay, well, that's a good start. So he riffled around his desk drawer, and then he looked up. He said, I don't have one here in the drawer. I'll have to go in the back. But since I'm the only one here today, you'll have to go outside so I can lock the door while I'm in the back. Well, that's an interesting go. But I said, look, no rush. I'm going to walk down the street, grab a sandwich rather than idle around outside the door, and then I'll be back, which I did. Walked in, he handed me the card. He said, here you go. But I don't know if this will work. I got it. Thanks. So I went home, hit the AT&T website, spelunked around the site till I found the chat link, fired it up. The person on the other end actually knew what needed to be done. I gave her a few numbers off the card, then pointed the camera on the phone at the card's QR code, and boop, it added the new cellular plan to my phone. Now, the chat agent then said, well, look, they've got a little bit of provisioning to do at the back end, and she'd text me when it was all done. So Irene and I went out to dinner with some friends all night, no text, no activation. I'm still running on the AT&T physical SIM. So the next morning, I hit chat again, and this time stuck with the chat guy all the way until provisioning was complete, and we tested that it worked. Then I pulled out the AT&T physical SIM card, put in the EE physical SIM card, immediately got a text from EE telling me that they're, you know, telling me what their US roaming charges were. So I knew I had that connectivity. And when I looked up top, there were actually two bars. I could see, you know, two cellular signal strengths, one for AT&T and then one actually for T-Mobile, which carries, which handles EE traffic in the US. So everything seemed to be working. I also got a whole new set of like slide bar selections in the cellular section under the settings app. Which line did I want to use for voice, primary or secondary, for data, primary or secondary, for iMessage, for FaceTime. I don't know, I spent some time on Apple's FAQ, frequently asked questions pages, trying to figure out which scenario works for me. I also went on a couple of other websites. I don't know that I completely got it. My guess is it's going to take me a bit of trial and error and probably some self-inflicted AT&T international charges kind of to really figure it out. But I think that, once I get it, then it'll be handy. Hey, and if you've got any travel stories, suggestions, questions, comments, tips, rants, the voice of the traveler, send them along, text or audio to comments, COMMENTS at travelcommons.com. You can send a Twitter message like Jim McDonough to M. Peacock. You can post your thoughts to the Travel Commons Facebook page or the Instagram account at Travel Commons or on the website at travelcommons.com. So the only topic on today's Travel Commons podcast is, will you still love Uber and Lyft when their prices go up? So Lyft's chief financial officer, Brian Roberts, said during last week's earnings call that pricing was becoming more rational. Rational pricing is sort of CFO speak for more predictably higher. And then Uber's CEO, during his earnings call, said, "We and Lyft are big-time competitors here and have been for some period of time, but for now we're seeing generally category positions that are stable. We're focused on improving profitability in this market," which is CEO speak for, "We're no longer going to slash prices to buy market share." Now, we all knew this time would come, at least the rational ones of us. I mean, Uber lost $5.2 billion, that's billion with a B, in the second quarter, just in 3 months, while the smaller Lyft lost a mere $644 million in the same time period. Investors, look, rational investors are only going to let you torch large piles of money for just so long. And so, hence the topic question, will we stay with Uber and Lyft even when they're not a bargain anymore? Now, I've actually been talking about this with frequent travelers I know, or frequent travelers I sit next to at a bar, or frequent travelers I bump into while waiting for an Uber at O'Hare. One school of thought, and kind of the prevalent school of thought, is that the Uber and Lyft experience is better than your typical cab. So even at the same price, you'd still order one of those. I mean, you can order it on your phone rather than running into the street trying to flag down a passing cab and figure out if the light on top of the cab means he's full or not, or he just forgot to switch the light. Indeed, I've always said that for me, Uber's prime use case is getting a ride from Midtown Manhattan to LaGuardia at the end of the day in somewhat of a sane experience. I mean, before Uber, I'd be practically dancing into Fifth Avenue, hiding my luggage behind a trash can, because if the cabbie saw that you wanted to go to LaGuardia or, heaven forbid, JFK, I mean, they'd like literally accelerate to get past you. Now, the last time I was in New York, I tried the cab company's iPhone app just for the hell of it, and it failed miserably. Now, adding Uber and Lyft drivers to the transit mix has also meant that you can now get a cab ride or a car ride from somewhere outside the usual downtown and tourist spots. And I remember pre-Uber New Orleans, getting a cab anywhere other than between the airport and the French Quarter was damn near impossible. I mean, one night for dinner back then, a group of us, we decided to go to this mid-city restaurant, Toop's Meadery. Like, honestly, just a phenomenal place. If you get to New Orleans, go to Toop's. When they say Meadery, it's Meaterry, and that's what they serve. The owner, Isaac Toop's, actually later made it to the finals of the Top Chef cooking show on Bravo Network. And he didn't win, but he was voted fan favorite. And I got to tell you, his food was our favorite too. The only problem with his restaurant was getting a cab back to the Sheraton on Canal Street from that mid-city location. I mean, one time the hostess called three cab companies and we ended up waiting 20 minutes for a 15-minute cab ride. And that driver told us at the time, he said, "Yep." He said, "All most cab drivers want to do is make the easy money, driving between the airport and the hotels." There's also fare predictability. you see the price to get from, say, downtown Chicago to O'Hare before committing to the ride. No more meter anxiety watching the numbers run up in traffic and the accompanying, will I have enough cash to pay, or will this guy's credit card machine work anxiety. And then with Uber and Lyft drivers following GPS apps, there's no more, am I being taken the long way around to run up the meter anxiety, or having to depend on your cab driver's knowledge to take the fast way, or having them punt it to you with the bridge or tunnel question that I would always get in LaGuardia cabs. Uber and Lyft's technology is really, I mean, it just helps avoid a lot of the bad experiences that we've all had in the past with taxi cab rides. I used to say that Uber and Lyft cars were nicer, but I think that bar has slipped down as they're scrambling for drivers in this full employment economy. An Uber I took last week was missing the door armrest, and then a Lyft that Irene took last week had the front right quarter panel held on with duct tape. Now, these are exceptions, but they're a bit more common than a few years ago. But they're still a damn sight better than the beat-to-hell Baltimore cabs that would sit at the cab ranks in the Inner Harbor. I only took them once because the cab rank was right outside the client's building and I was late leaving for the airport. The back seat was full of old newspapers and other crap, and there was no air conditioning, and this was on a July afternoon. After that, I'd stand there looking at the cabs, waiting the 5 to 7 minutes for an Uber to show up. Now, the place I most often take a cab rather than waiting for an Uber or Lyft is the airport. And here, it's not really about the price, it's the convenience. The cab ranks are usually right at the terminal exit, while the rideshare pickup spot can be sort of some sort of Easter egg hunt like in Vegas, a 15-minute walk to the back 40 like in Atlanta, or just some confusing scrum of screaming traffic cops like at Chicago Midway. Vegas and LaGuardia especially, catching a cab is so much easier than a rideshare. And actually here at Charlottesville also, it's a flat rate into town that's about the same as Uber and Lyft, and the cabs are in decent shape, so if there's one, it's that cab rank is literally right outside the door. There's just no reason to wait. And I could be wrong, but this whole pricing discussion feels mostly like a U.S. thing. In Paris last spring, none of the Ubers were rideshare drivers, as we would see here. They were all black car livery companies with professional drivers. I mean, near as I could tell, Uber was just another dispatch system for them. And then in Lisbon a couple of years back, I couldn't tell if they were true rideshares, but the pricing was about the same as the cab, and there were more taxis, so it was less weight. We just took the path of least resistance and just ended up hailing cabs. So the rough consensus of my completely unrepresentative polling was ridesharing initially got traction because it was cheaper, but now it's just become an ingrained reflex, and the technology gives such a better experience that quite honestly, most people would pay even a premium over a taxi ride. But I wouldn't want to tell Lyft or Uber that. But from what they said on their earnings calls, I think they've already figured it out. Okay, that's it. That's the end of Travel Commons podcast number 154. I hope you all enjoyed the show. I hope you decide to stay subscribed. I hope you decide to feel the urge and write a good review on iTunes or SoundCloud or some other such place that you get your podcasts. Check out the show notes for music links. And like I said, find us on SoundCloud, Stitcher, TuneIn, Alexa, iTunes, Spotify. The links along with the RSS feeds are on the right-hand side of the Travel Commons website under the heading Subscribe. Right below that in the social media section are the links to the Travel Commons Facebook page, Twitter, and Instagram feeds. Check out that Instagram feed. Starting next week, I'll be posting a couple of pics from Krakow and Budapest, and I'll try to make sure they're not all from inside of craft beer bars. For those of you who I'm friends with on Untappd, you'll get those. And if you have a story, thought, comment, gripe, the voice of the traveler, send them along. Text or audio file comments, COMMENTS at travelcommons.com. M. Peacock on Twitter, the Travel Commons Facebook page, the Travel Commons Instagram site. Post them on the website at travelcommons.com. Thanks to everyone who's taken the time to send in emails, tweets, post comments on the site. And until next time, when I'm back from our Eastern European jaunt, hopefully with a couple of travel stories. Until then, take care, travel safe, and thanks for stopping by the Travel Commons. Bye now.